Special thanks to C.H.R. Hansen, a leader in fermentation and innovative brewing solutions. C.H.R. Hansen's range of high-quality yeasts includes Smart Bev Near, which crafts flavorful beer entirely without the alcohol. These yeasts even enable fast, climate-friendly, and cost-efficient production. We thank C.H.R. Hansen for their support and commitment to excellence in brewing. This is the Master Brewers Podcast, brought to you by the Master Brewers Association of the Americas, a volunteer organization dedicated to continually improving the products and processes of our membership since 1887. Let's go! 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 Master Brewers brings you interviews with the industry's best and brightest in brewing science, technology, and operations.
Calm down, I'm moving too fast.
This episode was made possible by the following sponsors.
Discover more ways to enhance flavor and maximize beer yields with Salvo. Now available in varieties like Sultana, Trident, Lotus, Calypso, Cascade, and many more. Discover how Salvo can help boost your brew at hopsteiner.com.
Berkeley Yeast, creators of diacetyl-free yeast strains. Diacetyl-free strains are bioengineered to produce the ALDC enzyme inside the yeast cell to keep diacetyl low during fermentation and after packaging. Diacetyl-free strains create the cleanest flavor profile possible, which makes them the yeast of choice for the most exacting brewer. Go to berkeleyyeast.com to read about how brewers are using diacetyl-free strains to propel their beers to the top of the podium. Grist Analytics captures and trends data across the brewery so you can see issues as they are happening, not several batches later. Get real-time feedback on the brew deck, analyze correlations from the lab, and see scheduling predictions from anywhere. Connect Grist with your ERP platform to cover your brewery from production to finance.
You know, you have this fresh batch of Munich malt that you just got out and it goes into the beer in 3 weeks instead of 6 months. I mean, you're going to taste the difference.
That's the kind of stuff that, to me, just I love about craft malt is being that middle person where I can help facilitate something that's a win-win for both people on the supply chain.
Is that dollar staying in our state, our community?
You're a craft brewery, but where's your ingredients coming from?
This week on the show, we celebrate the first decade of craft malt by catching up with a few of its pioneers.
Hello, I'm Brent Manning with Riverbend Malt House in Asheville, North Carolina.
Andrea Stanley from Valley Malt, and I am in Massachusetts.
Todd Olander, I am with Root Shoot Malting and Olander Farms in Loveland, Colorado.
I want to begin by saying that I think most people know that I am a fan and friend of craft malt. But brewers don't listen to the Master Brewers podcast because they want to hear commercial pitches or get told what to think. So I'm going to have to play devil's advocate and ask you all some tough questions. But let's start off easy. When I visited Colorado Malting in 2010, it was my first look inside a craft maltster, and I don't think they were getting a lot of visitors back then. Andrea, I believe you were the only other craft maltster in the U.S. that I'd heard of at the time. A few years after that, the North American Craft Maltsters Guild sprung to life. Why was the guild established?
Well, the guild was established because there were just a few of us, as you mentioned, and around 2012, I think, I was probably getting a couple emails, a couple phone calls every week from people interested in starting their own craft malt house. The social worker in me said, oh, it seems like there's a need for information, and that kind of triggered the idea that, you know, with collaboration and some sort of association similar to the Brewers Association, we might be able to harness all of this energy and excitement about craft malt to a place where we could share information and, you know, become better maltsters.
Why is craft malt good for brewers? How does craft malt help them make better beer?
it can be more consistent and higher quality. I mean, when you are working with a maltster that can communicate with you directly instead of kind of going through the all the different channels that sometimes you have to go through if you're trying to get information when you're dealing with a larger company, sometimes you don't get those answers. And I mean, we've always focused on quality, and I think all craft maltsters, I mean, that's really what we want to rely on, is making sure that people are making better beer. And we want to make sure that all the people that we're selling malt to are succeeding, because if they don't succeed, then we don't succeed.
You know, I'll say that for us, it's about flavor differentiation. You know, it's like we've got a lot of opportunities. I always tell people, like, if I have an elevator pitch for craft malt, it's like, you know, we have a lot of different people working in non-traditional areas, growing varieties that maybe you're not haven't had access to, and everyone has different equipment that allows them to put, you know, their own distinctive spin on flavor. And I think that's really where things get exciting to me, as you know, we approach 9,000-10,000 breweries in the nation. Like, what are you doing to help sort of stand out in that crowd? And I think, you know, selecting super fresh, really intentionally produced malts is a great way to sort of stand out. And, you know, to Todd's point, have that conversation with your maltster about, like, you know, what style of beer you're thinking about brewing and what flavors you're looking for. You know, sort of that open dialogue, I think, is one great step to building a better beer.
Andrew, you want to add anything or no?
Well, I think that it's hard to say as a craft maltster that, you know, we're trying to create better quality malt than other sources of malt that, you know, let's just say, for example, Weyermann, you know, they've been doing it for generations. I think that where the quality might be better for a craft brewer is in the freshness. The fact that our malt is being kilned, packaged, and mostly brewed within a month to 2 month period really does affect the quality of the malt. That freshness when you're cracking it and you're brewing with it does translate into the beer.
It's not dissimilar from, you know, when I make coffee, right? I don't want to use beans that have been sitting around for a year and a half. I want to use beans that were roasted last week, right?
That's a great analogy. Yeah. And think about the process. You're turning something, you know, you're crushing something that has been, you know, created to a certain profile. The sooner you're able to crush that and do all the steps properly to bring that flavor forward and the aromas forward of that coffee, that is appreciated by the consumer. So I think that other than the step of fermentation, you know, it is a very similar analogy.
What have been the keys to success when it comes to helping brewers reach successful outcomes with craft malt?
For us, persistence and consistency. I think it's, you know, a lot of breweries, it's, you know, it's pretty easy to just stay with the status quo, right? And then, you know, but if you're a craft maltster and you want to break into their flagship IPA recipe, you know, that's a relationship that's built over time. And that there's a lot of trust tied up in there, and it can get torn down very, very quickly. And so I think that's, you know, something that we spend a lot of time with is building trust through consistency and, you know, open communication.
Yeah, I would agree with that too.
Todd, earlier though, you said, you know, if they're not successful, you're not going to be successful. What steps do you take in that relationship to guarantee that brewer is going to be successful? How do you shepherd them through the process of using your malt so that they have the best possible outcome that they can get?
Well, I mean, it comes back to education, I think, and that partnership, and making sure that they have a COA in their hand before they actually brew with it, and just knowing what they're getting so that they know what they can expect. We can offer some other things like grist analysis with their mill. I mean, milling is a huge part of the whole process. You need to know, like, if the friability is a lot higher than what you're normally using, then you need to adjust your mill so that you're going to have success when you start mashing and lautering. So, it just really comes back to that good communication and knowing that we want everyone to succeed, and we're going to do everything that we can to do that.
Yeah, I agree with everything that, you know, as you sort of get feedback and you see where brewers are adjusting to craft malt versus like maybe another supplier that they've been using, you kind of understand the ways where your malt might differentiate. And so you can kind of talk to the brewer ahead of time and say, like, for instance, Todd is, you know, bringing up friability. Or like I know for us this year, for the first time in 10 years, we had slightly lower plumpness with one of our lots of barley because of the growing season. We had brewers that were very committed to wanting to use this barley because of where it was grown and the farmer who grew it. And so just communicating, you know, flagging that issue and communicating it and working through that. So, you know, that's, I agree on all of that. It's kind of interesting. When you asked this question, I was thinking about more answering it as far as succeeding with making sure that the brewer is able to understand the value proposition of craft malt. So it's just interesting how we've approached answering this question. You know, I think that I found success in working with brewers when we have been able to, they have been able to, and we help them to understand the value and be able to communicate that to their customers.
Okay. So for them to be successful, they've got to not only, you know, brew a great beer and make the most out of your malt, but they also have to understand why it's important and how to communicate that to the end consumer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've got to get, you know, the most productive meetings, you know, that I feel like we have are the ones that where you have, you know, you've got some front of the house people, the brew house staff, you've got the marketing people engaged, and you're able to sort of loop everything together so that all of those people hear the same story. And then that information makes that all important leap across the bar to that consumer. And that's really where that value proposition, you know, starts to really, the rubber hits the road.
Cool.
It really helps to have people come visit your malt house and actually understand the whole process and understand where their grain is coming from. Like, take them out into the field and let them see the grain growing and then run them through the malting process. And if you can get like front of house people, that really makes a big impact.
I would like to add that one of the impressive things that I'm seeing, not across the board, but a decent percentage of brewers now are using the malt hot steep method in order to evaluate different malts in order to build a recipe for a beer.
Yeah.
Now more than ever, when folks are asking for samples and I ask them, are you planning on hot steeping this? Their answer is, yeah, that's what we do. So I think that the work that the Craft Malt Guild put into helping to, you know, share obviously the American Society of Brewing Chemists created that method.
Yeah, but bringing more awareness to it.
Awareness to it, making sure that people understood that this method is highly accessible, easy, and can really help you develop an understanding of your malt supply chain and what you really want from your malt feels like a success to me when I get those emails and I send those samples out and I know that my malt is being evaluated with the hot steep method along with other malts that a brewery is evaluating.
Which beer styles are best suited for craft malt inclusion?
All beers? I don't know. I think there's an opportunity now in the lager and pilsner area because that's really highlighting the malt and the cleanliness and just that's usually what brewers are going for nowadays is to have this nice, clean beer. And if you can be the showcase, as if our malt can be the showcase in that beer, I mean, that's amazing. Oh, but there's also all the kind of roasted or highly toasted malts that we're making that just make a huge difference if you're including that because of the freshness as well. You know, you're like we touched on earlier, that, you know, you have this fresh batch of Munich malt that you just got out and it goes into the beer in 3 weeks instead of 6 months. I mean, you're going to taste the difference.
I'm a huge fan of Belgian saisons. They're not, palatable on the craft beer market at the moment, but I definitely think that's another area where, you know, if you've got an heirloom rye variety or, something that's got that, that rustic character to it, I think that those types of ingredients can shine in Belgian farmhouse beers.
I would say pilsners are probably our most successful style to work with brewers on. Something that we just pay a lot of attention to how we make our pilsner malt, with the feeling that it's going to be being put into a malt forward lager. And over the years, as that style has continued to grow, we've seen that brewers are looking for craft malt to make special pilsners in their portfolio.
How do you compete with big malt that's a lot cheaper or with big ingredient suppliers that are positioned as one-stop shops for brewers?
Well, it's not the price differentiation that we used to face. So that, I would say, is the delta.
Gap is closed.
Yeah, the gap. Yeah. The gap is closed. So that's one piece there, and the other piece is that I think when you can offer the level of traceability and customer service that craft malt brings to the table, and innovation and customization and all of those things, I think it's you're always going to walk into breweries that are 100% bottom line oriented, and that's great. You know, we all have to be successful business owners, but I think once we can get a toehold with a seasonal or a one-off, I think people can begin to get a feel for what craft malt can bring to the table. And or if they had a bad experience or two with some of the bigger houses, I think it's pretty easy to step in and say, well, here's how we work and here's how we fix that type of problem,
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, the big ones are not immune from quality problems. I can speak to that with experience.
I just want to say that a lot of it's customer service. And when somebody can just reach out to you and say like, hey, what's going on with this? And then you can just go back to that batch and within a minute or two kind of discuss what that COA is telling us and give them feedback within minutes. I mean, I think that's pretty valuable. And making sure that their malt delivery is on time. I mean, the supply chain has been an issue over the last few months, or not last few months, last few years, just with COVID and everything. So,
okay. Kind of a similar question, but not really, is in situations where craft brewers are paying a premium for a craft malt, which, as you said, that premium may not be as big as it used to be, but when they are, how can they make sure they're getting the biggest bang for their buck?
First and foremost, it's getting everybody in the organization around the table and putting in the effort to make sure that everyone that is involved with that beer, between the brew house to the tap wall to the distribution channel, that everybody knows that something different is in this can, bottle, pint glass, whatever, and that name drop the farm, name drop the malt house, really, use those marketing assets to sort of build that value proposition. You know, we've seen, customers get, end cap placements and, just preferable positioning at distro and, beers that feature local ingredients, just get a little bit more traction with beer writers, media, et cetera. And so I think that's, it can be a challenge sometimes, the brewer is gone by 2 or 3 in the afternoon. The marketing person doesn't get in till 4 or 5 maybe, or maybe there's one bartender that really cares, but the other 2 or 3 don't, so it can be a challenge. So, but I think if we can get all those folks in sync, I think typically there's an uptick in sales that sort of, pays dividends figuratively and literally.
I think that for our customers, certainly them understanding how much we appreciate their business and how much their business means to forwarding our mission. And we sort of, I think they understand that in most of the communications that we're having. But then in addition to that, we've started, going back about 5 years now, at the end of every year, we're sending the breweries that we work with decals for their tap room that show how many acres of local agriculture their purchases supported that last year. So that's all kind of like a customized thank you. And then over time, we've created these appreciation banners so that when a customer has reached the point where they've supported 10 acres, 25, 50, 100, 250, they get a new banner for each of those achievements. So that we're really pulling in the impact on local agriculture in a very individualized way, creating digital assets so that they can then share that through social media and on, in both in person in their tap rooms, but also kind of to a broader audience. We still get really excited about these kinds of things. And I would say that a majority of our customers do as well.
Coming up,
Aaron McLeod, when he was at Hartwick, gave a presentation at one point to try to debunk that myth.
I'm John Bryce, and you're listening to the Master Brewers Podcast from the Master Brewers Association of the Americas. There's really only one thing that keeps this podcast going, and that's when listeners like you take the time to thank our sponsors. The next time you talk to a rep from one of these companies, be sure to thank them for their generous support.
Introducing Gambrinus IPA Malt, the heart of hop-forward beer. Possessing an elusive color falling between very pale Pilsner and golden pale ale malt, Gambrinus IPA Malt is a low-color-based malt tailor-made for IPAs. Brew with Gambrinus IPA malt and discover balancing sweetness and body, with a delicate profile of bread, toast, grain, and a slight nuttiness. Order a Gambrinus IPA malt from BSG or learn more at bsgcraftbrewing.com.
Get to know Proximity Malt. We malt superior, European-style, low-protein varieties grown close to home in Delaware and Colorado. Domestically grown, precisely malted to style. With our team of seasoned experts and 2 brand new malt houses, try what's really new in malt. Check us out at www.proximitymalt.com.
Positively impact your process, product, and profitability with actionable insights from BrewIQ, the industry-leading real-time fermentation monitoring solution. Visit www.precisionfermentation.com/MBAA to start saving time and money today.
BSI, your brewing partner since 1996, is your destination for top-quality liquid yeast cultures, lab services, and brewing products. BSI customizes your yeast orders for the perfect healthy pitch rate from a collection of over 300 strains. Most strains ship within 7 days, but now try BSI's Express Yeast with industry-favorite strains shipped the next business day. As of 2023, BSI is proud to be a 100% employee-owned business. Professional brewers can call for a free same-day consultation or visit brewingscience.com to access over 50 years of brewing expertise. Are you sure you're getting the best deal? Visit the Lupulin Exchange, where you can find every hop variety, every brand, and every vendor. Compare prices, reviews, shipping speeds, reliability, and more on over 1 million pounds shipping direct from every hop merchant and grower in the U.S. The Lupulin Exchange. One stop, all the hops. And here's what's coming up on the Master Brewers calendar. District Texas meets virtually March 21st. District St. Louis's March Shop Talk will be at Blue Jay Brewing March 21st. District Philly meets March 22nd at Workhorse Brewing in King of Prussia. District St. Paul Minneapolis meets at the Minnesota Craft Brewers Conference March 22nd. District Montreal meets March 27th. District St. Paul Minneapolis has a bowling social April 2nd at Town Hall Lanes. The District St. Louis Spring Quarterly Meeting is April 8th. District Northwest meets in beautiful Hood River May 10th and 11th. The Master Brewers Brewery Maintenance Systems course begins June 6th. It's time to save the date for the 2024 World Brewing Congress. That's August 17th through the 20th in Minneapolis. Check out the full calendar of events at mbaa.com for more details or to find a district meeting near you. Now back to the show. Okay, is craft malt significantly different in regards to sustainability?
I think so.
Why?
Why?
And how?
I mean, it comes back to like the local supply chain, the small supply chain, the carbon footprint, and just things that are that farmers are doing on a very local level to reduce kind of that impact. I know a lot of farmers that maltsters are working with and us specifically, we're using a lot of regenerative practices to make a healthy soil so that we have resilient soil and resilient grain. And I know I've talked a lot about quality, but I think it's really important that I think if you have really healthy soil, that's going to result in really high quality grain year after year after year, even though there's some environmental impacts such as drought or some warming temperatures or extreme rain events. So, I mean, I think just local agriculture in general is trying to, make sure that supply chain is of highest quality.
Being in a non-traditional barley growing region like the Southeast, I think it's definitely easier to make those claims. You know, we're in, I always tell people when I give tours, you know, the closest major malt house to where we are is in Wisconsin, and they buy their barley from Wyoming, and that, you know, sort of sets the table for a story that where I'm, you know, purchasing a majority of our grain from a couple hours away from us. And so I think, you know, now modern climate accounting might have, you know, might look at things, but, you know, moving via rail car versus 18-wheeler and, you know, get down to some pretty challenging numbers. But I think overall for us, I look at the sustainability through a lot of lenses, not just carbon emissions. You know, it's about, you know, is that dollar staying in our state, our community, you know, or how are those types of transactions occurring? And I think that's where craft malt absolutely wins.
Cool. Andrew, you want anything to sustainability or no?
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely, we look at sustainability and a lot of the ways that Todd and Brent talked about. We also are committed for the last, I think since 2018, to only using compostable or recyclable packaging. So we're, you know, for as hard as it is to get used to it, we're doing, you know, paper bags. We purchased an electric van in 2021. I know we just did an analysis and, you know, we saved 1,300 gallons of fuel last year in making deliveries to our customer in an electric van instead of in gas-powered delivery vehicles. So we purposefully built our new facility in a city that has almost 90% of its electricity coming from renewable electric. So, you know, in terms of sustainability, we're trying to do everything that we possibly can as we make decisions about our business. And like Todd said, it goes even farther into the type of agriculture that cereal grains, small cereal grains, promotes. And those, you know, at least here in the Northeast, growing cereal grains is mostly a winter growing pattern, which really helps to contribute to, you know, less erosion and less sort of leaching of nitrogen and to waterways and creating algae blooms and that sort of thing. So, you know, and then just sustainability in general, where we're providing a stable and growing, you know, it's a growing market, but it's growing very in a stable way where growers can anticipate how much they can rely on a craft malt house to buy what they're growing. So I think, you know, sustainability is one of those terms that can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And I think we're just trying our best to really think about malt being a product that in the future does contribute to cleaner air, cleaner water, more, you know, healthier soil, happier people. You know, those are the things that we're trying to look at in terms of sustainability.
How have you seen your suppliers, so the barley farmers, how have you seen them evolve since you've been working with them?
For us, it's been a, you know, just, we love, I always tell people that we, you know, are always looking for farmers who are students of the game, you know, folks that are interacting with agricultural extension professionals and trying to, you know, constantly bring a better crop to market. And so I think, you know, we've benefited from that approach. We've benefited from both public and privately developed two-row barley varieties becoming available in the Southeast. And, you know, as Andrea mentioned, we're also winter barley territory. So, you know, it's been exciting to watch farmers sort of fold us into their crop rotation schedules. And it's been great. Everybody's gotten better.
Andrea, how about you?
Well, we've seen investment in infrastructure, farmers that feel more secure in putting in grain storage, grain cleaning. And so that's been really helpful in us being able to grow our business and get more grain from local farms, is that, you know, this infrastructure is kind of being built up as growers are seeing success in working with a craft malt house.
Yeah. Well, I guess We are the farm, I guess, which is kind of unique in the craft malt scene and just malting in general. So, I mean, we have the control of deciding what we're going to plant and how that's going to impact our soil and our crop rotation and everything. So, but we've definitely gotten better over the years. You know, before 2016, when we opened the malt house, we were growing barley for Coors, and you know, like we weren't probably focusing in on what was most important because we were just selling that basically as a commodity crop to Coors. And now that we know that the protein level and why that is so important in the finished malt, you know, like we have taken lots of different steps to maintain a really high quality barley, a nice plump. We have irrigation, which really helps us in this region, so we can help keep the stress level down on the grain during the growing season. So we do work with a couple other farmers too, and we communicate with them regularly to make sure that the barley that we're getting is going to be suitable for malt.
Do you malt everything that you grow, or do you still sell some to Coors?
We do not sell anything to Coors anymore. So we're growing. The whole goal of starting the malt house was to sustain the farm, really. So we want to have everything that we grow besides some rotational alfalfa running through the malt house or being sold to distilleries as raw grain.
How is craft malt misunderstood or mischaracterized in your eyes?
Wildly inconsistent, wildly expensive.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think early on, there was probably some truth to that, right? But now that, I mean, Andrea and Brent have been operating for 10 years or more, and we've been operating for 8 years, there's a lot of malt houses. I think, what, there's over 60 craft malt houses, and a lot of them have been operating for quite a few years. And, you know, they've figured out how to continually make consistent malt. I don't blame a brewer that doesn't want to have a different experience every time they brew with your malt. So, I mean, that's just not going to work for anyone. I guess when we first started talking with brewers in our region, we went to like Odell in New Belgium, and the first thing they told us is that they need consistency. And so that's what we focused on.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, you know, I feel like, you know, demonstrating through, you know, passing along that C of A, you know, letting people in on what our in-house QAQC program looks like, but, you know, all the things that go on behind the scenes before that bag goes on the pallet, I think is a great step forward to helping debunk some of those myths.
If there was one thing you could educate a naysayer about craft malt, what would it be?
I think it is the consistency question. I think that for some reason there is this bias that because you're doing something on a small scale or because you're using local ingredients that you can't achieve consistency. And I think that, you know, with the adoption of both Montana State University and their malt lab, you know, them being able to do malt analysis, and the Center for Craft Food and Beverage, they can do malt analysis. You know, you can now just look at the data and see that batch to batch, a craft malt house is just as consistent as batches or truckloads of malt coming from larger, you know, larger producers.
And even more sometimes, right?
Even more sometimes, yeah. In fact, Aaron McLeod, when he was at Hartwick, gave a presentation at one point to try to debunk that myth, and worked with a few craft malt houses and breweries that were getting silo fills in, and they were able to sample their silo fills. Hartwick did analysis on those and then did analysis on the craft malt batches, and the consistency was there both, you know, on the small scale and on the large scale. So
on the financial side too, we always kind of invite people to really, you know, go through invoices and really see what your true landed costs per pound are from some of the larger suppliers. You know, I think, you know, sometimes maybe a top line price might seem, a quoted price might seem a little, more than they're paying. And then again, by inviting them to like really, you know, review that last shipment and see what your true landed cost per pound was, you know, I think you'll see the delta is shrunk even more, you know. And so I think there's that sort of, people think in their head that they understand what they're being charged and what their COGS are per pint. And then it's like, but, you know, it never hurts to revisit those numbers.
Yeah. I would say that like most malt houses that are operating now have quite a lot of automation, and that helps with consistency. And then, kind of on what you're getting in the bag also, like, we're taking lots of time and care and effort, making sure that like what you're getting is strictly malt. It's not like twigs and sticks and sometimes rootlets. There's just that extra care that goes into every single bag. We're making sure that the cleanliness is up to standards and hopefully higher than what they might get from another supplier.
What is the malt cup and why should brewers care about it?
So it's our annual sort of our Oscars, I guess. It's just a way to recognize malt houses for producing outstanding examples of different styles of malt on an annual basis.
Yeah, it's similar to GABF, but people aren't drinking beer all day, I guess, when to get the results. So, you know, it's based a lot off of the like COAs to make sure that like the malt is viable. And then a lot of it comes down to sensory and the hot steep analysis.
Okay. Is it something brewers should pay attention to, or does it not really affect them?
I mean, I think they should pay attention to it, and a lot of them do. And, I think Brent's won some malt cup awards. I don't know if Andrea participates or has participated, because I think she a lot of times judges.
Being very humble, and I would just like to point out that Root Shoot Malting has been a winner of the Craft Malt Cup for many, many years. And, it's definitely something that, when you look to understand who in the industry is really at the top of the level, I would say that the Craft Malt Cup, you know, does help a brewer understand if they're looking to engage with craft malt, here's a resource of, you know, a very well executed competition. I know how the competition works and all the different levels that Todd is talking about that goes into the submissions and how they're, brought to the final judging piece and how that final judging is done. And it's rigorous. And so the people that win the Malt Cup are, you know, some of the best maltsters in the world, because it's not just craft maltsters that are participating. It's maltsters from all around the world and large, you know, large and small. It doesn't just have to be a craft malt house.
That's a good point. Most folks may not realize that it is an open competition, that there's the opportunity for malt houses large and small to go head to head, and it's exciting. Each year there's always somebody, I remember when the guys from Italy won a couple of years back, and I was just like, holy cow, that's fantastic. I've never heard of these guys, you know? And so I love that those types of stories can come out of the competition. Yeah, the competition's been steadily growing over the past few years, and it's big shouts to Hannah Turner at Montana State for all the work that's gone into that. Lindsay Barr, list goes on and on. Tons of folks come together, all our judges, to make it happen. So it's a huge undertaking.
Harmony Bettenhausen does a lot with it.
For sure.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Does the world need more craft maltsters, or are we good?
I don't think it could hurt. I think, I think right now with where craft beer sits, it's a much different market to enter than when most of us came into being. So it definitely not the same path to success, I think, that the market, the craft beer market is a completely different animal than it was, you know, in the early 2000s or early 2010s.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is more room for craft maltsters, and I think that the amount of time that we've had to sort of see folks come and go, come and stay and grow, I would hope that people have a better, that are looking to get into it, have a better picture of what really goes into running a craft malt, you know, starting and running a craft malt house. And, you know, I think that the barriers to entry are a little lower now because there is equipment available. There are supply chains that can, you know, supply grain to emerging craft maltsters. There is education now, and the Craft Malt Guild is there. So, I mean, a lot of the pieces are in place that weren't there for those of us that started, you know, over a decade ago. So I would hope that it's a little bit easier, but I would hope that people also have seen those that have come and gone and understood what the challenges are to make sure that they can succeed if they are going to invest their time and money into starting a craft malt house.
What's the future look like?
Well, I hope to see more and more craft malt houses continuing to enter the market. I do think there's room for that, mostly to support the local economy and local farms. You know, it gives farmers another outlet for what they're growing, and it just gives them a little opportunity to get out of the commodities market and the big market swings that commonly occur. So that's where I see kind of the growth happening in the craft malt scene is actual farmers trying to diversify their farm and vertically integrate where they're actually selling what they're growing.
You know, for me, I see a lot of excitement around, you know, adaptation. There's a tremendous amount of energy and research being done on new barley varieties that, you know, maybe are beginning to grow winter barley in traditionally spring only areas. You know, new varieties for us in the Southeast, which I think is just a great opportunity to differentiate. You know, more we're seeing, I don't want to use the word retreat back to tap rooms, but, you know, more of a renewed focus on tap room sales. And I think that gives an opportunity to sort of educate the consumer, like we were talking about earlier, in a much more effective fashion, and with these new varieties designed to help us adapt to the changing climate, I think we've got a really exciting opportunity to engage people.
I think that, you know, I always see, you know, sometimes when you're having such direct relationships with your, you know, with the brewers that you're working with, or the farmers that you're working with, you see where the opportunities might be going, you know, where the next opportunities are coming from. And so, I mean, I'm just thinking, like, a very tangible example right now is for craft malt, at least on the distilling side, there are a lot of distillers that are interested in barleys that don't have GN, because that's just becoming a potential risk for single malts and other spirits. And, you know, here we are, like, I literally have a farmer that is willing to grow a variety that doesn't have any GN for a distillery. And, you know, just like the excitement of being able to solve a problem for somebody and build a market for a farmer in the meantime. That's the kind of stuff that, to me, just I love about craft malt is being that middle person where I can help facilitate something that's a win-win for both people on the supply chain.
That was Andrea Stanley, Brent Manning, and Todd Olander here on the Master Brewers Podcast. Check the show notes for a link to the Craft Malt Guild's website where you can learn more about what's going on in the world of craft malt and how to join the craft malt revolution. Are you enjoying the Master Brewers Podcast? Let me tell you about a simple way you can help us keep making more. Take a minute to thank our sponsors. There's no way we could produce this show without generous support from sponsors like Hopsteiner, Proximity Malt, BSG, Precision Fermentation, and the Lupulin Exchange. So please, let them know you heard their message on the Master Brewers Podcast and that you appreciate their support.